All right, so I'd like to open September's Interpretation Committee meeting. First of all, we've got an IFRS 15 issue, paper 2. And Satanik, are you going to kick that off?
Yeah. So agenda paper 2 discusses a submission on the pattern of revenue recognition in a contract for a sale of a unit in a residential multi-unit complex. The main facts of the submission are presented in paragraph 5 of the agenda paper. And based on details in the submission, we have prepared our analysis, assuming that the entity has concluded that all of the criteria in paragraph 9 are met in of IFRS 15 and has identified one performance obligation in the contract, which is a promise to transfer the real estate unit to the customer. The requester asked whether the entity recognizes revenue over time or point in time. And to make this assessment, the entity would assess each of the three criteria in paragraph 35. We have analyzed those criteria in paragraphs 11 to 27 of the agenda paper. Paragraphs 15 and 16 of the paper analyze the criterion in paragraph 35b of the standard, which relates to the customer controlling the asset as it is created or enhanced. In the fact pattern, the asset being created is the real estate unit. So the assessment is about whether the customer controls the part constructed real estate unit as it is being constructed, and it's not about whether it controls the right to obtain the unit. Paragraphs 20 to 27 of the paper then analyze the criterion in paragraph 35C of IFRS 15. In our view, in the fact pattern described in the submission, none of the criteria in paragraph 35 of IFRS 15 are met. Accordingly, the entity would recognize revenue at a point in time. And I would like to pause here and direct your attention to question 1 on page 8 of the agenda paper and ask if you agree with our analysis and conclusion in paragraph 26.
So just before handing over to you, I just wanted to mention one other thing, which is you'll be aware that we received a letter on agenda paper 2 just recently. For those listening in on the webcast, that letter is available on the website on the meeting page, just titled Letter Received on Agenda Paper 2. In particular, that letter is supposed to provide some comments on our analysis in the paper, and specifically about the analysis of paragraph 35B of IFRS 15. So with that, we'll hand over to the committee.
Okay, so question 1, whether you agree with the analysis of the application of paragraph 35 to the fact pattern set out in the submission. Who wants to go first?
I'm sorry that I am the first person to talk, and I also have a severe cold right now, so maybe I cannot talk well today. But first of all, I agree with most of the step analysis. However, I have several comments. The first one is the application of paragraph 35C, especially the entity's enforceable right to payment. As I mean, the staff conclusion was that because there is a cancellation of the contract by the court, this criterion is not met. But I think there are several things that we have to think. The first one is how rare the court decision is. I don't believe that court make a acceptance of that kind of request to cancel the contract every time. But in most of the times, the situation is going to be very restrictive or very rare. The second point I want to say is that this is a multi-unit contract. So for example, in Korea, so construction companies are building not just one or two units per one construction, but sometimes 5,000 units at the same time. So what if a one or two or only a few units are canceled by the court? Do we also have to say that also violates the criterion in paragraph 35C? So what I'm trying to say is that in case when the contract is rarely canceled, or in case where only a very small fraction of the contracts are canceled in multi-unit contracts, still, do we have to say that criterion of enforceable rights to the payments is violated? And another one I want to say is that we have to think about the unit of account also. Here in this example, there are two units of account, I think two different types of unit of account. The first one is a contract by contract. The second one is a construction itself. So So, for example, out of 100 units constructed, only 2 units are cancelled by the court. Then do we have to say that, you know, the whole 100 units are the ones that we have to say the criterion is violated? Or by the contract, only 2 units are violated, but the other 98 units are not violated? So, I mean, the unit of account is another issue that we have to think of this issue. And last one I want to say is that, you know, the paragraph 35B, in that case, one of the example in BC 129 is that if a building is built on top of the customer's land, then that should be counted for as a kind of the thing where the construction, I mean, the percent of completion method can be applied. So, you know, what if I think there is some kind of variations of the contract? For example, you know, the land is transferred to the customers as soon as the contract is completed. Then the contract becomes, the nature of the contract becomes whole different. Now the construction company is building a building on top of the customer's land, where we can apply paragraph 35B. Then maybe percentage completion method can be applied in that case. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the case in this agenda paper is very simple. You know, there are many other things we have to think, like the materiality, frequency of the of the violation, as well as the unit of account. And also there could be a lot of variations of the contract. And I believe that many countries are watching this meeting because, for example, in Korea, this is a big issue. We have a very, very similar, you know, industry like this one. So that, you know, but, you know, I believe that, you know, their practice is going to be a little bit different between countries, between jurisdictions. So this decision is going to have a huge impact, but there could be a lot of So what I'm trying to say is that whether should we think about those kind of variations or not.
Young, so I think you raise a couple of good questions, and maybe just to make a suggestion for other committee members to think about before they speak. I think it would be interesting to get some thoughts from people, if it's something you've looked at before in particular, about whether the existence of a right is what matters in this analysis, or the likelihood of exercise of that right, because I think that was partly what you were touching on there, Young Soo. And I think also another thing that could be interesting to focus on a little bit in the discussion and analysis would be whether there's particular things that are determinative in terms of the analysis. So, for example, the question I think you were raising there about the title of the land, whether that would be determinative. And I think the other one that might be interesting to touch on a little bit would be the extent to which the how pre-cooked the design is comes into the analysis of control as well. So is that determinative? I've got my own personal views on those things, but I won't show my hand. But I'd be very interested if people think they've got views on those topics. I think that would be interesting things to pull out, because I agree with Young Soo that it's really the thought process, I think, that's going to be most interesting to people rather than the black and white answer. And it would be good to tease some of those things out. Now, Carl, I think you're the next person with your card up.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I'm concerned in the same area. I'm concerned with the fact that some stakeholders have different views of some important assumptions that this analysis was based on. I believe this is important to understand if some changes in that assumptions over the same fact pattern can lead to different conclusions and about the application of paragraph 35, especially 35B criteria. For example, the land, the title of the land is very important. As described in the agenda request, it's possible to transfer the legal title of the land at inception. I would like to understand and see further analysis if that is the case. Would the outcome of paragraph 35B diagnostic different? Would the fact change the understanding that the customer really controls the asset? as it is created, and 35B criterion of IFRS 15 is met. Would it change the assumption on paragraph 6B of the paper in terms of the performance obligation being the construction itself and not the transfer of the real estate unit? I think some different assumptions might lead or not to different answers. So I think further analysis of different assumptions would be helpful to be brought to this committee.
I think it could be helpful, but I think it's also going to be quite important that we, in the first instance, have a sort of clear discussion on the fact patterns and then make a discussion about whether particular aspects are determinative or not, because I think it would be helpful to be clear on the particular submission that we've received, particularly given the time frame that we're looking at with the IFRS 15, but also not to sort of have people overreading what was maybe meant in the discussion if that's not what the committee meant. Now, the committee's very shy this morning. There must be somebody else who wants to put their card up.
To answer your question on what criteria should be determinative, I don't know. I cannot quote all criteria in this instance, but I would say the most important one for me is when does transfer of control occurs? And I think this, to answer also another of your questions, this can be probably assessed at the time you initiate, at the inception date of the contract, when you initially set the rights and obligations within the contract, when the two parties created their respective enforceable rights and obligations. Surely it can help to assess whether transfer of control has occurred or not. Having discussed with some people in my jurisdiction, transfer of control is not transfer of risks and rewards. It means that it doesn't mean because the entity has not control any longer that transfer of control has passed to the customer. So it means that the customer needs to control effectively the good or service sold. I would say it's, for me, in this analysis there, it's really what is the most important criterion to analyze. In the letter we received recently, you cannot, in the letter, find any new elements to assess this transfer of control, or unless I've missed something.
Bob.
These questions are difficult, and the primary difficulty is sifting through the facts. They are very facts and circumstances specific. I agree with the staff's analysis. As I went through it, 35A I think is pretty obvious. 35C, I agree with the analysis. On the question that you ask, I think it's the existence. It's not the probability. It's not whether who has and who hasn't. It's the fact that the customer has the right that is important to me in that analysis in 35C. I think where the real issue in this case is, it's around 35B and the control aspects. To answer your question, is there anything that's determinative? I think title is pretty powerful. It's important to me, but it's not determinative. I'm not sure there's anything that's determinative. I think you have to look at the whole of all the facts and circumstances. In answering 35B, I kind of what I asked myself was, what is the asset upon the signing of the contract? What is the asset that the customer has? And it just seemed to me in the facts what the asset that the customer has is the rights under a contract. It can sell the contract. I'm not sure I'm convinced that they have the right to the land and the construction in progress.
Okay, thanks. Tony?
I think very similar to Bob. I agree with the staff analysis. I think looking through, starting with 35B, I don't think there's any single factor that would be determinative in deciding whether or not the customer controls the asset as it's being constructed. There are factors that the standard suggests that you should look at, but what I also thought about when I thought about the paper was that the board was clear in the basis of the conclusions that there might be circumstances in which it is not clear whether control has passed. And I think at least it is not clear in this case. My view is that control hasn't, because as Bob says and the staff paper says, I think the right to receive the completed property is different from controlling the property. But at the very, even if someone was to say, well, there might be some indicators here of control having passed, it is not clear. So I think the standard directs you to move beyond 35B and think about 35C. And there, to answer your question, I think it is the existence of rights, not the actual exercise of the right. So if the customer is able to cancel, and whether it's corporate law or contract law or the actions of the court or whatever it is, provides evidence that the customer will be able to cancel and will not be obliged to make payment that compensates for work to date. I think that's the fact, rather than whether or not a majority of customers choose to exercise. So I was comfortable with the staff's analysis. I agree that different fact patterns in different countries might lead you to a different answer, but in this case, I'm comfortable with where the staff's got to.
I think, for me, the first point to make is that when I look at different contracts and arrangements in different jurisdictions, there is a slightly different analysis typically in all of them. And in practice, when we're looking at the question of point in time or overtime revenue recognition for this type of sale, it depends very much on the jurisdictional facts and circumstances. And so it wasn't surprising to me in the paper to see the reference, for example, to Malaysia, where there is a specific fact pattern. However, I don't think that fact pattern is the same as the one that we're dealing with here. And so I think there are two points to make. One is that, consistent with what a number of people have said, I hear growing noise around the question of sales of real estate, particularly apartment blocks. And so that may be something we'll need to think about a little bit as we go forward. But in this one, I'm very much in the same place as the staff. I agree with the analysis which is there. On a couple of the specific questions that were asked, if I look in this fact pattern at 35B, I think that the way that I might analyse this is that I'm not at all convinced that the land is distinct in the context of the contract. I think the contract is for the delivery of the apartment on this, in this particular block, which happens to sit in this particular bit of land. But I don't think in the context of the overall promise by the construction company to the customer that the land is separate from the apartment itself. If I look at paragraph 35C, and on Sue's question of is it the proportion that you might expect or is it's the existence, I think it is the existence of the ability of the customer to walk away. And that is consistent, I think, with the guidance in the standard itself, which talks about the vendor must have the right to consideration in all circumstances other than vendor default. And so there is a circumstance here which is other than vendor default, and I think that no matter, that it may be a relatively small number of cases, that means you fail 35C, and I believe it was deliberately written in a very restrictive way. On the more recent letter that we received, consistent with others, while there is some useful additional information in there, I didn't see anything in the fact pattern that we were provided with which would change that conclusion. So I'm comfortable with where the staff have got to. I think that it's the right answer in this fact pattern. The one question is, in view of the number of different contracts that we have, in view of the questions which are coming up quite regularly, whether there might be some additional work, perhaps some additional outreach from the staff to various jurisdictions to understand more about the types of contract that we're seeing in practice.
Thanks, Andrew. Martin?
It reminds me a little bit on the topic of penalties with regard to income tax, whether penalties belong to IS 12 or IS 37, and it's really based on the national tax law. In this case, for sure, it's not based on national tax law, but on national law and interpretation of the law. So it's very much facts and circumstances driven. I mean, here we judge on the given facts and circumstances without knowing really the background of the law, and a slight difference could lead to a detour or to a different result. And I agree with the staff. I'm pretty much with Andrew and Tony. And for me, the question is, what is the overall outcome? Would we now come to the decision not to put it on the agenda and to explain it? Or would be the result to put something in educational material? Because I fear if we really start to solve such a national topic, individual based on national law, what is if another nation is coming and saying, hey, however, we have a slight difference, and how we have to judge on that? And I guess we are more or less putting ourselves in a specific corner, which might be dangerous to get out then later on. So for me, it's more the question how I label the overall outcome of that discussion and what to do with that, than more or less doing the judgment based on IRS 15, because as said, with regard to the staff analysis, in a way I'm comfortable with.
Thanks, Martin. Jimmy.
I agree with the staff analysis. Given the fact pattern written like this, I think the outcome is quite clear. And I just want to add that, as many mentioned, the principle itself is quite clear. The thought process is more important than the outcome. The outcome could be highly local, depending upon the local legislation and the reinforceable or not the contrast or even the title. So I think it's not that important for us to give them a clear outcome, just to tell them what to think. And it's up to the local legislation or the professionals to decide the outcome. That will be better than just telling them you must be going one way or the other. I think the one-time recognition should be more reasonable and common in this type of constructions. Given the current technology, how soon are you going to build a building or an apartment building? It may take a year, but 2 or 3 years, it's a little bit too big of a project. I think this issue might not be that big. Just one, this particular building may take 1 year, and it happened to cross a reporting period. That's it. I think if we give them a clear wording on our tentative agenda decision to tell them what to think, that's good enough. Otherwise, we'll run ourselves into the local law or legislation situation. We don't want to. So I think it's up to the locals.
I think both Jimmy and Martin have raised interesting points in terms of what the form of the output might be. We're going to come back to that again later too, so I'm not ignoring you and I'm not responding to that. We'll be back. John.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the staff analysis and just on this fact pattern. I think it's point in time. I don't think it meets 35B or 35C. I think 35B and the issue of control is actually, it's fairly difficult. I mean, I don't think title or ownership of the land is determinative, but I think if you ignore it, you have to be able to draw a distinction between an interest in the property and an interest in the contract. And I think people often say, oh, I'm able to sell my party completed unit, but you're not selling a party completed unit, you're selling an interest in a contract for a finished unit. And I think those are different. So I think if you move away from title and say that's not important, I think there has to be strong evidence that there's other ways that what you have is control of the physical asset and not just an interest in a contract. And I don't think being able to dispose of it or sell it or pledge it is actually tells me that it's anything more than an interest in a contract. 35C, I think it's the existence of the right. I know, for example, in a number of Asian countries, the legal advice is that they do have an enforceable right to payment for performance. But it's rarely tested because what happens within a rising property market is the customer defaults and the developer sells the unit to someone else, and they're quite happy with that outcome, actually, because you generally make more of a profit. So it's not tested in terms of getting an enforceable right. You know, you don't enforce your right, even though the advice is that it is enforceable and you could actually force it on the customer. I mean, the test would come in a declining market as to whether courts would uphold that particular right. And there's an absence of case law in many jurisdictions as to whether courts have upheld that right. I suppose the question becomes then one of jurisdictions as to how enforceable is the right which may exist in the contract. I mean, it seems in the fact pattern we have in front of us, the court has set aside those rights, but how often has it done it? Has it done it in one extreme case of hardship, or has it done it many times? I think that's going to depend on facts and circumstances in individual jurisdictions as to whether you do have the right. And I think that's really difficult to, you know, it's very difficult to, I think you just have to make a judgment and an assessment on that based upon the facts and circumstances in individual jurisdictions.
You're focusing on that as an enforceability question as opposed to how often does it get?
I don't think it's got anything to do with likelihood. I think it's the existence, and whether a court would uphold the existence of your right, I think, is critical. But again, if it hasn't done it once, does that mean it's not going to do it in any contract? Or, I mean, I think that's...
It's judgment.
Yeah, it's just judgment. But overall, in this fact pattern, I agree with the staff analysis.
Bruce?
Thanks, Sue. When I took a look at it, I kind of agreed almost immediately with the staff on it. I mean, to be very fair, I actually was wondering if I'd missed the issue, so I spoke to two companies involved in this who would love to come with an alternative view. Both of them said, look, as much as they wish they could get to an overtime recognition, they both accepted that this was a point in time. So interesting, it's just two people who I think would have thought to have got it the other way both agreed that they would have done it. Just on your question on the existence of the right, when I thought about it, I mean, to me, the fact that we're in a control paradigm, wherever else we think of control, in my mind, is always in the element of an existence of a right. So that's kind of where we're in that. My last comment very quickly is just there's a bit of touch in terms of, well, should we do additional outreach, should we do education material and that. My view on this would be no. And I tell you why. I think that if we start trying to extend this, we're going to get a flood of very specific fact patterns that we'll need a team here just to sit and analyse for the next 3 months. So I wouldn't have picked it up. I'd leave it as is.
Reinhardt.
My comments are consistent with the comments made by others. I agree with the staff analysis, and I agree with the others who have talked about that under 35B, it's important to understand what is the asset that the entity has, whether it's a right to the unit or whether it's actually the unit itself, which is very important, and maybe facts and circumstances specific. And then similarly for 35C, I agree it's the existence of the right that's determinative. And so thinking ahead along the lines of what others have said, I had a similar concern as to what the agenda decision might look like or the form of the agenda decision. I think it'd be helpful to enunciate some of these principles that we've talked about. Because rather than taking on various jurisdictional specific facts, because I don't think as a committee we should be in the position as others have said, of judging on various jurisdictional specific facts, but providing some helpful guidance that would enable entities in those jurisdictions to test as to whether they would meet the criteria or not, similar to what we've done on IFRS 9 questions, where we've had some very jurisdiction-specific or very instrument-specific issues that we didn't take on the agenda because it was too specific. But in other cases, we provided some guidance that could be applied more broadly.
Bertrand?
Yeah, I didn't mention that I agree with the staff analysis, or at least with the staff conclusion. Maybe on the first criterion, on paragraph 35C, so the paragraph 36, actually, maybe it has been stated, I think it's Tony or Bob, I don't remember, that stated that. I would have focused on the fact that I would have focused more on the fact that transfer of control does not pass as the asset is being constructed, rather than on the fact that there is a substantive contractual restriction. Because it's the only thing that bothered me with the letter you passed us is that they mentioned the fact that effectively you cannot argument the fact that there is a substantive contractual restriction because everything had been set up at the inception date of the contract. So I think effectively this is a fair comment, but I'm not sure it has a consequence on the conclusion, but maybe then in the tentative agenda decision we should more focus on whether control as passed or not, as the asset is effectively being constructed, even in paragraph 36. I'm not sure the substantive contractual restriction is really determinative in the conclusion.
So just to understand what you're saying, Bert, because paragraph 36 in IFRS 15 relates to 35C and the
yes.
first leg of that criterion and yes. saying, okay. does the asset have an alternative use?
Yes.
And so you're comfortable with our conclusion is that leg of criterion 35C is met because there is a contractual restriction. Are you just thinking that needs to be explained
no.
better?
No. What I'm saying is that maybe you're not enough focusing on paragraph 35B on the fact. Sorry,
right.
if I was my words were not clear enough. You're not maybe focusing enough on 35B on the fact that control has not really passed to the customer. Okay. And in paragraph 36, maybe you should effectively take into consideration the comments that has been made in the letter received, questioning your analysis on the fact that there is no substantive contractual restriction, and maybe analyze a bit more on this specific aspect. It's the paragraph it's paragraph 5 of the letter we received that effectively mentioned this.
Yeah.
And I think probably it has to do also with John's comments on and so maybe it's not just that the customer has in terms of engineering no right any longer to direct the construction of the asset because this has been preset. It's maybe not that argument, but more probably the legal argument that the asset can be redirected to potentially to others, i.e. these specific arguments. So if you ponder all arguments, this argument is maybe not as determinative as it appears to be. It's not equal weight to the paragraph 35B, probably.
Well,
if I'm clear, this morning, but...
while I remember, Sandy, are you on the line and did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I am on the line. I don't have anything else to add from what's already been said.
Okay.
I agree with that conclusion.
Thank you. Tom.
Yes, thank you. In the interest of consistent application and consistent enforcement of IFRSs, I would like to echo the message from Reinhard when he's saying, okay, we are not in a position to assess all, based on all national law, these type of contracts. However, we should provide useful guidance to preparers, to auditors, to those who have to apply the IFRSs. Because there is some criticism of this committee that sometimes when there are local issues, the local people are not provided with useful guidance, and that could and will result in local interpretations which might harm the consistent application and consistent enforcement. So I think it's very important that for these type of questions there could be useful guidance to assess based on local law how to account for these type of questions.
Thank you. Yansu?
Yes, I just want to go back to paragraph 35C just one more time. I agree with Bob and the others that the paragraph 35C focuses more on existence than the probability, frequency, or materiality. I agree with that. But you know, what we have to do is think about the economic substance. So what I'm trying to say is that the frequency of canceling the contract is in case very low. Not using percentage completion method really represents the economic substance of the construction. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that the standard says more about the existence. I agree with that. But if you think about the economic substance, do you really agree that not using percentage completion method is the real one that represents the economic substance of the contract? So that's, I think, what we have to think.
I think what John said is very important in that context. Mm-hmm. Does it reflect the economic substance in a rising market? That's why I think the rights are important. So if it doesn't get cancelled very often because the market is rising, or if a customer does cancel it and the developer can sell it without enforcing its rights, I'm not sure that just because there haven't been many cancellations that have been enforced in a rising market influences the outcome one way or another. I think the focus ought to be on what rights the developer has to be paid. And like John, I think there may be a couple of interesting conversations somewhere down the future if some of the markets in Asia turn into declining markets at some stage in the future.
Time will tell.
It has maybe more to do, but to echo what Tony has just said and to echo what I've tried to say earlier with difficulties. If you read your paragraph 20 in the agenda paper, it has more to do with the B than the A. And in the agenda decision, you were focusing on the A, but I think probably it should be more focused on the B portion of this, on your quote of paragraph 36, because it echoes more what John or Tony have just said. And it will indirectly answer the concerns expressed in the letter that you received later.
Bonnie?
So I agree with the majority of the comments the staff's analysis. I think what is critical to me is making sure that it's clear that these are very facts and circumstances specific, and that the agenda decision is very focused on how to interpret. I can't remember who said it's not necessarily the conclusion, but rather how to interpret the words for these specific fact patterns. And this should be framed as a guide, not we're interpreting this specific fact pattern, because I agree. I don't think we want to invite other specific fact patterns to be analyzed, but rather it's the thought process and the analysis that we need to go through.
I agree with that. Okay, so sounds like we have got agreement on the analysis, so now we can move on to questions 2 and 3. So the second question for the committee on page 10 is whether you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add this matter to your standard setting agenda. I can have a show of hands.
Agree not to
add it to the standard setting agenda. Bob and Sandy, do you agree? Not to add it to the standard setting agenda?
Yeah, sorry. Yes, sorry. It takes me a few minutes to get off of mute when I do that.
So okay. Yeah, no, that's why I wait for a moment, because I presume you're dealing with mute. Okay, so that's 13 committee members. So then the next question is whether you have any comments on the proposed wording on the tentative agenda decision, which is outlined in Appendix A. And maybe just before I ask for specific comments, I completely agree with committee members that our job is not to sort of get a stream of people's fact patterns and for us to opine on the fact patterns, not least because it would just be unworkable for us given the resources that we have, but also it's not our role. But I think that what we should be trying to do with the agenda decision is to make it clear what the logic was and what the questions were that needed to be answered when you apply the standard to the fact pattern. I think where the fact pattern does help, though, is by having sort of that reference, it helps make it a bit more real how you do that application. So I certainly agree that we shouldn't be sending a signal to the market that, you know, now you can send your fact patterns in and you're going to get a yes or a no. But I think applying the circumstances and the facts to the analysis is a helpful sort of frame of reference for people. But we need to make sure in that regard, I think, that we've done as much as we can in the agenda decision to write it in a way that it gives as much help to different fact patterns as possible. That's not very well expressed, but hopefully you know what I mean. So with that as just some initial thoughts, specific comments on the draft agenda decision?
Bonnie? Mm-hmm. I just echo what I previously said. I think it's important to maybe lead in with this is a very specific fact pattern. Our purpose in the agenda decision is to provide the guidance on how to interpret IFRS 15, not to interpret the specific fact pattern. So I think it's important to lay out what our purpose is.
Explain what the logic was.
Yes.
Just to echo this very safe comment.
Bertrand?
Yeah, maybe I totally agree with your comments too, and maybe we could, because it has been said earlier by some, we could probably just put a disclaimer saying that in the tentative agenda decision that it's an illustration of the application of IFRS 15 and the way to apply IFRS 15 in specific, based on a very specific fact pattern that maybe is not replicable to other contracts or situations, and. In the tentative agenda decision, because I think it's also something that could be helpful, the way to have some paragraphs within IFRS 15 interact with one another, is to probably also mention an analysis on why criterion 9E is met. So there is a contract because the entity expects the payment from the customer. Does not conflict with the fact that there is a possibility that a court decides and then implicitly cancel the obligation. So the difference between the payments to assess whether there is or the legal right to payment, whether there exists a contract or not, is not similar to what would appear more as a default from the customer ultimately. So I would probably have focused on that, and probably on paragraph A of the agenda decision, the tentative agenda decision, replace "it does not have legal title to the unit" with the words "it doesn't have legal control to the units," and then quoting the legal title as potentially being one of the examples why legal control has not passed. But otherwise, I think it's even though it's very specific, it helps. I think it was an interesting case that might help people see the way you need to analyze paragraph 35 within IFRS 15. So.
Just on that last suggestion about changing it from focusing on title to control, personally, I think that the fact pattern is based on the sort of the facts, yeah, which exactly. is the title yeah. question. But I agree with you that the question that's 15 then tells you need to answer is, has that been a transfer of control? So I think that way personally would be better, unless others. John?
I mean, I understand some of the comments about not making it too fact pattern specific because you might get inundated with requests, but I think you have to have, I mean, we have received a submission. I think otherwise, if we make it too general, we're doing an interpretation through an agenda decision. So I think we have to actually answer the question asked in the submission, and we need the facts in the submission. But I think there should be the pertinent facts that actually result that we think are relevant to the conclusion that we've reached, and illustrate how those facts, by application of, you know, by application of IFRS 15 to those facts, you get this answer, and therefore the standard, you know, we don't need to do an interpretation because the standard is clear in its application. But so I wouldn't make it too generic, because I think then you're actually effectively interpreting the standard.
I agree with that, but I think that some of the ideas that people have raised about being very clear up front that it's sort of an illustration and the purpose is to explain how to apply the requirements in 15 just send a message that sort of indirectly that we're not in the market for answering specific fact patterns. But I agree, I think to make it meaningful for people, the facts actually help you understand the analysis. So I would agree with that. I guess my only question is whether there was anything that was missing from this or emphasis that would make it more useful to apply more generally. So some of the points that we've been talking about, for example, the existence of rights and whether particular things are determinative, whether committee members had any thoughts on whether any of that would, you know, be a helpful thing to modify in any way in the draft words. Bruce?
Yeah, thanks. I guess I'm kind of somewhere in the middle of what everybody's saying, because I think I'm very worried when I read this. This is 2.5 pages of analysis of a very specific fact pattern, and that's my worry. Is we're really, you know, I'm going to sit here and say, oh, I actually don't have number C, therefore this would not apply at all. I'm just very, as I say, look, we can issue it like this, but I think, so there's a mix between, I agree, we need to address the fact pattern, we don't. I would have almost kind of turned this on its head, and I would have said, we've requested somebody to talk to us about how we deal with real estate. And then I would have laid out the principles we've been talking about, the structure in which we would apply. And then you could say, look, for illustration, the facts illustrated were as far as, I'm just very worried that, and I know where you're coming up, we do need to answer a question, but wow, you know, it's going to be like, the moment somebody sees a small difference, we're going to start getting people saying, I'm out of that, therefore this doesn't apply to me. So, but this, I agree, let's look into drafting here, we could be all day.
Okay, thanks, Bruce. Martin?
And for me, the question really is whether we intend to answer the submission. Yeah. It reminds me a little bit on the topic of IFRS 11, where we also elaborated a little bit, and then we end up with 8 or 10 pages, but which was not really an answer of a submission, but which was more guidance how to interpret this standard in specific facts and circumstances. So this probably would help us, again, not to be in a narrow corner or so. I'm not sure what would be the appropriate instrument, whether it could or should be educational material or whether it should be an agenda decision. But I believe we should be a little bit broader than just focusing on the submission, and also the discussion here, it came out that detailed answering the submission would probably be too short. And we should be a little bit more to explain why and what.
Thank you. I'm just, sorry, I'm listening to two conversations. I think that the what I'm hearing is, I think there'd be two different sort of general approaches we could take. One would be that it would be very much based on analysis of the facts and circumstances, and then a bit on 15, but the emphasis would be on the answering the submission question. Or we could flip it around the other way and make it more about this is how you think about the analysis in 15, and that would be the predominant part with a shorter reference to then what that would mean for the fact patterns.
And maybe as a starting point to say, I think the way we put this together is probably more the first. So it's more answering the question with what we try to do as well, though, put in a little bit of the thought process you might go through, but the thought process in the context of answering this question.
I wonder whether it would be more useful to more people if we flipped it on its head and did it around the other direction. If people want to comment on that, those who are coming in, then I'll suggest that maybe a few committee members could work with the staff to try and achieve.
Yeah, so if we got that broad agreement on outline, we could then work on the exact case.
Tony?
Yeah, and that's largely what I was going to say. I think we can achieve both of the objectives if we explain the way we think 15 works in this context. That will also be helpful for people who are thinking about other fact patterns, and therefore it's providing something helpful through the agenda decision, but we can still answer this specific question based on that piece of analysis.
So that would be sort of drawing out on the first part to say that applying 35B requires you to clearly demonstrate control, and then we can have sufficient facts saying that in this case it's there isn't sufficient to conclude that, therefore 35, you know, you have to test 35.
And I think there are a number of things that different committee members have said that I have. So when you go under 35B, for example, emphasising it's the existence of enforceable rights, not the frequency of enforceability, and that's probably not the right words, but we can bring out some of those thoughts. So that's the way I think I would prefer to do it.
The other difficulty is you kind of need to have quite a few facts, because as you said, it's a sort of like a B is a holistic assessment. Mm. It's no single fact is the killer determinative fact, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Andrew?
I think I would agree with that as well. I think that we could work with the agenda decision much as drafted, but includes a little bit more on here are the principles that you need to apply in IFRS 15, and this is how they might be applied in this specific case. But I think, consistent with others, it would be helpful to have quite a careful introduction to it to explain what we're doing. And also to have something which very clearly says that the application of these principles in different facts and circumstances may give you a different answer. In relation to a couple of points, I think bringing out the question of existence for 35C would be helpful. And also, consistent with my earlier comments, I think something on 35B of needing to consider whether one element specific in the context of the contract as a whole, because I think in this case that may be relevant. On the question of what we might have done previously for other standards, one thing I'm quite conscious of here is that we're 3.5 months away from the date of initial application. And so I would very much like to get this agenda decision finalised and out there in a way that it can be helpful across a broader range of different jurisdictions and entities.
Jennifer?
I think Tony and Andrew said most of the points that I was going to say. I had the same concern as Bruce around, given that this, we know these real estate transactions have been a big issue in many jurisdictions in terms of how to apply IFRS 15, the risk that others will read the fact pattern and say, well, I don't have that specific fact, so either I just ignore what's here or I come up with my own interpretation, so which as Tom has said, it's not going to lead to consistent application. So I agree with I think what Tony said as well around maybe we can find a way, and Andrew as well, around, again, making clear that this is just one illustration. You have to look at your own facts, and different facts can lead to different conclusions. Obviously, I think we all know that, but just sort of hitting people over the head with that. And then I think also on the analysis of 35B, if we could, I don't have specific wording suggestions, but to make it more clear what is the asset that's being transferred, what are we focusing on, I think would be helpful.
Okay, thank you. Mary?
A couple of thoughts as I reflect on the committee's discussion that I want to recap here to see if anybody has concerns about my characterization. First of all, I thought Bertrand's two specific suggestions were very important that they get captured in terms of the agenda decision, you know, the paragraph that starts in the fact pattern described in the request, blah, blah, that's the intro to the 35B analysis, bringing out that the point is about assessment of control before identifying the factors that might be indicators of control. The second is something that I hadn't realized until you made the comment, which is when you look at the analysis of 35C, there is a fair amount of focus supporting the conclusion that one trigger is met, which is the inability to redirect, but there's not a lot of commentary supporting the one that is the problem for satisfying 35C, that even though the contract itself may not provide for rescission, the pattern in this jurisdiction of some history of rescinding the contract is what creates the right, because there's very little analysis in this decision of that pattern, of that fact, and that's what I heard Bertrand, you saying, which is the analysis of 35C focuses on one but doesn't have as much on the other. The other observation I had, and I'm inferring this from some comments, I think it probably is not necessary or even appropriate to capture, but I wanted to test, which is generally I heard people not agreeing that 35B could be, you know, when considered in the context of this type of contract, that it would be inappropriate to really think about it as I have, you know, think of, you know, so your 5,000 units built on one piece of land, that I have a square of land this big, and that, you know, and that is notionally transferred to me separately on day one, and therefore it fits under 35B. I didn't hear anybody supporting that way to read 35B. And actually, in the context of these multi-unit, that might be something to bring out, but it might be too much in terms of cluttering an agenda decision. But in terms of messages, going back about how IFRS 15 is applied to analyses of off-plan contracts for multi-unit, I think that further aspect about 35B and that reading might be, you know, useful for all of us to think about.
Yeah, thank you. Just to echo Martin's comments, I'm very concerned to issue a decision on this specific fact pattern. I think we need just to highlight the principles and how the analysis must be done, and not being the judge of specific fact patterns.
Okay, thank you, Carl. So, the good thing is I think the majority of the committee are agreeing with the analysis, and so I think a lot of what's been said reinforces the analysis we've already got in the paper, and that's already in the draft agenda decision, so that's good. I think there's been a couple of extra points that have been brought out about the existence of rights and the fact that one element's not determinative in the analysis of 35B, and also I think the point about the clarity around what asset are we talking about, and the control point that you suggested, Bertrand, which I think would be good to make sure we've brought out enough in the agenda decision. Then I think the other thing, and I'd like a show of hands on this, is what I'm hearing is that we're thinking that we will not change the content too much of what's in the agenda decision, but more reorder it, so that it's more clear how you step through the analysis of this control point in IFRS 15 using the requirements and the standards of what the assessment is, and then as a sort of secondary thing, illustrating the application of that using the relevant facts in this pattern. My preference, and I want to test this given what Carl just said, is that the committee is still concluding on the outcome in the same way as we did in the draft agenda decision. It's rather a reordering rather than not giving an answer in terms of the actual facts in the submission. But I would like to just test that with a show of hands from committee members, if I could.
Can you repeat the question? What the question is?
Well, firstly, that you agree with the reordering of the decision, of the agenda decision, so that it focuses first primarily on how you apply the requirements in 15 and sort of as a secondary, sort of secondary emphasis is the facts and circumstances to illustrate the application in this case. But the other thing, so that's the first thing I wanted to test, that you're happy with the reordering. The second, so maybe a show of hands on that first.
That's everyone.
13.
Sandy.
And Sandy.
My hand is up.
Thank you. The second thing that I would like to test with the committee is that we would still keep the observation, which is in the second to last paragraph on page 13, which is that based on the fact pattern described, the committee observed that none of the criteria in paragraph 35 are met, and therefore the entity would recognise revenue at a point in time applying paragraph 38. If I could have a show of hands, that would still be included in the agenda decision. And Sandy?
Yep, my hand's up.
That's 12. That will go out for comment, obviously, but that will be what will be in the decision.
Even though you can word it with a disclaimer saying that it's a specific application on a specific fact pattern.
To try and make it clear that, please don't send us all your fact patterns if that's what you
mean. You can add that also. You can add that also.
Love us to be useful.
Yeah, but on this one, I think it's important that we do answer the question.
I think it is too, because it has consequences for consistency. And given that we are doing a rejig as opposed to just a few drafting changes, I'll ask the staff to reach out to some committee members just to confirm the reordering of the agenda decision. John?
Just a clarification on the point that Mary made about the transfer of land at inception. Is it intended to put that in? Because I think that's not something we've really debated about whether that is actually transfer control or not. So.
Personally, I'd prefer not to talk about that unit of account point because we didn't really focus on it. I agree with you in this fact pattern, but I think it's one that might be quite jurisdiction and specific.
We might get that question next month.
We might. Leave that for another day when we analyse it thoroughly. Thank you. Very much. An interesting discussion.